Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff. Welcome to this edition of Induction Who Needs It. We are talking about objectivity, Aristotle's concept of objectivity. And at the end last time, we reduced the concept and at the end reached a list of stages that we would have to go through, starting from observation to end with the concept of objectivity, or at least with the concept of, with the knowledge that we need a method, and with a lot of knowledge of what that method would consist of. So that's where we're going to pick up today. And the first step that we indicated last time was to arrive at the distinction between percepts and concepts. What the Greeks called sense versus ideas. Now, that was originated by Socrates and Plato. It's hard to say who did what, because it's hard to tell where Socrates ends and Plato starts. But at that, basically, Socrates and Plato originated the concept, and then it was developed further along more rational lines by Aristotle. So let's look first at what Plato did. He got the concept of idea, or what we call concept, the same way you reach any concept. You observe similar instances in contrast to something different. You observe tables as against chair. And Plato identified similarities which united ideas in contrast to sense experience. He specifically identified them in contrast to sense experience. Now, if you study Plato, you know the kind of contrast that he listed. He had a whole list of attributes that he belonged to concepts or ideas as against percepts or sensory experiences. And here are a few of the obvious ones that his dialogues defined. Ideas were general or universal, like humanity. They embraced countless instances, whereas sense experiences were particular or concrete. You perceived Tom, Dick, or Harry, specific men. And if you know Greek philosophy, you know that they had already for a long time made a huge distinction between the one and the many. All the way back to Thales, they had tried to find what's the one common denominator uniting the many different things. So what Plato did really was to grasp that that basic physical distinction was applicable mentally, and that the concept represented the one, like humanity, going through the countless many instances. Ideas, he said, were non-material, or if we drop his mysticism, we can say they're conscious products, whereas sensory data involved an interaction between physical objects and our bodies. And Plato, of course, knew that perfectly well. He was the first to define that sensory observation involved that kind of interaction. Ideas, Plato said, are motionless. For instance, humanity never changes. It's true. Once you know what that is, it remains true throughout the ages. Whereas individual men, sensory objects, are continuously changing. Born, grow, age, die, etc. Now that's just some of the attributes that he discovered, and we can throw out some of his the mysticism that he injected into this distinction. But leaving that aside, this was the first time in history that the distinction, and he got the essence correct, between the perceptual and the conceptual was ever identified. And this was what enabled the Greeks to get started on epistemology. Now, I trust you see that there were a great many inductions necessary for Plato to reach this distinction. For one thing, he had to grasp that this faculty of ideas was possessed by all men. That's an induction. In contrast to animals who don't have these ideas, judging by their actions. So we have another universal. All animals have sense perception only, but not ideas or concept formation. And he had to generalize from the ideas that he studied to the fact that every idea would have that same cluster of attributes. Whatever has universality would also be, quote, non-material, would be immutable, etc. That is another induction. Now, these were not difficult inductions for Plato and Aristotle. There was, they saw them throughout the whole range of concepts versus percepts, and they were quickly integrated with the long-known idea that man is the rational being. Now, before that, there was just, he could reason, he could think, but as a result of Plato, it was grasped that reason, man's distinctive faculty, was the faculty of ideas, and or universals, as they called them, as against animals who had only the faculty of sense. And that was really what started us in business as epistemologists. I think we're going to need those lights on. All right, now let's continue up the chain. Before we can get any idea of method, of using one of these to check the other, we first have to discover something about error. That we said was the next step in the process. Now here, I'm going to Aristotle, was the one who made the crucial discovery, starting with Plato's distinction between sense and ideas. Aristotle observed that the senses can't go wrong. He actually stated this explicitly. It's the intellectual interpretations we offer of the data that can go wrong. And here again, he went by a common sense induction without even a clear understanding of the mechanism of the senses or of the way we form concepts. But he gave this kind of example, which you could obviously multiply endlessly. You see and hear a chariot crash, say. You go up and touch. You feel. You burn. You cut your hand on something sharp, etc. These data don't lie. So far as it's directly the testimony of your senses, it's can't go wrong. But when you go on to decide that Alcibiades is a bad driver, and it turns out that he wasn't even in the chariot, you make a mistake. Now, from instances like this, it was easy for him to generalize. A great deal had to be done later to completely validate this distinction and bring it to full consciousness. But we can say that in substance, Aristotle grasped the infallibility of the senses and the fallibility, the capability of error, of the conceptual level. Now let's go on to another point. More, that the issue of the role of will, where we're in control and where we're not. Because this represents another difference between sense and ideas that the Greeks had to discover. They had no trouble in grasping what we would say that sense data are automatic, but ideas are not. And of course, if ideas were automatic, if they were not within our control, we couldn't do anything about correcting. Now, the idea that the sense data are automatic, that they're not an issue of our will, both Plato and Aristotle knew by explicit observation. Every sense example and every modality, seeing, hearing, etc., that they examined, was a case of a physical object striking an organ. It involved no mental work and no choice on the part of the perceiver. Whereas on the idea level, this wasn't so. Implicitly, and I stress implicitly, they both grasped the principle that on the conceptual level, we do have choice. Now, the reason I'm stressing that this last is only implicit, they knew that the sense operated automatically, but it's only implicit their grasp of free will applied to the conceptual level. For one thing, there's no explicit discussions about free will in the works so far as they've come down to us. So we have no real way to know exactly what they believed on that topic. We also have to be wary here because both of them are what objectivists would call intrinsicists. They both construe the conceptual level on the analogy of the perceptual. You know, that's the theory that just as a a table acts on your senses automatically to give you the percept of table, well, they thought that the idea or the concept of tableness acts on your mind automatically and even infallibly to give you the idea table. Now, of course, if they had carried out this approach fully and consistently, they would never have reached the idea of objectivity or the need of it. In fact, they would have repudiated the need of any method. Because if our conceptual level is inherently passive and purely reactive, as is the sensory, then just as with the sensory, there's no need or possibility of any guidance on our part. And as a matter of fact, Plato was perfectly consistent here. That's just the direction he went in. He said, what you do to find out the truth or validity of a concept is just let it strike you. We knew it all in the preceding world, and you just have to trigger the memory and suddenly, bang, anamnesis. You remember, and that's all you need. And that's why, even though he had so much going for him in the direction of discovering logic, he never could get to the discovery of logic because his idea that the conceptual level functioned automatically cut off his ability to go in that direction. But despite Aristotle's intrinsicism, he wasn't, if you know him, as bad on that or as otherworldly as Plato. He had an Aristotelian side along with his Platonic side. And he was therefore able to think that there was a choice in the realm of ideas. In some way, he made the induction that choice, and therefore, by implication at least, setting a direction, effort, self-supervision, deliberate change of direction is possible on the idea level as against the sensory level. In effect, he observed that no act of will can affect sense data once we're exposed to an object, and no special mental work is required. And the opposite of this is true on the idea or intellectual level. So the restriction of free will to the conceptual level is really an inductive conclusion from observing numerous instances of the role of choice in one realm as against the other. So by the time of Aristotle, the combination that we needed was grasped. In other words, the knowledge that the same part that can go wrong is the one within our control. And by contrast, that the part of our cognition that's out of our control, the automatic, the sensory, is also not subject to error. Now, with that, the ground was the basic ground was laid to get somewhere in epistemology and specifically with regard to objectivity. But you can't yet go straight to the need for objectivity because so far we don't even have a glimmer of what to use as a guide to direct and correct our consciousness. We know that we have a part of our mind's content that can go wrong and is under our control against a part that is automatically right. So somehow we have to use our will to control the way we function with concepts, learn to use them correctly. But the question is how? What in the world do we do with our free will to get our ideas to correspond to reality? Now, it takes a genius like Aristotle, and you can't be much less of a genius than Aristotle, to come up with the idea, which, putting it in really simplistic terms, what about if we use the safe part as the standard against which to test the other? What about if somehow we can use the part that's capable of error and bring it back to test it against the part that we know is infallible? Which, of course, raised the question, but the two are so opposite. The whole development here rests on their opposite in every way. How could you ever make a connection of any kind between them? In fact, their huge difference was what Plato used to conclude there must be two opposite realities, a reality of universals and a reality of particulars, because in every attribute they have opposite characteristics. So the question is, what did Aristotle have to learn to answer Plato here? And he specifically set out to answer Plato. What did he have to learn about ideas or concepts that would enable him to relate them to back to sense data in this world, and thereby say there's only one world, and there's a way of bringing concepts back to percepts? And in essence, of course, his famous discovery was you have to discover that ideas come from sense experience to begin with. One idea, which was a really startling discovery in the sense that the logic of the whole development here was how different they are. And yet Aristotle had to be able to grasp that the one came from the other, and that was a necessity of getting the very possibility of objectivity. Now, we know that the essence of objectivity is the ability to reduce our ideas to sensory data, which is our only direct contact with reality. And we say that a conclusion is false or invalid or arbitrary if we can't take it back to sensory data. So, as objectivists, we know that the senses are the standard of objectivity, which are counted on by logic itself. Logic, as we're going to see, consists of establishing a conclusion by basing it on an earlier conclusion and so on all the way back until you reach the self-evident starting points, which is sensory data. All of this development, however, is possible only if we first discover that concepts originally come from the senses. If Plato was right and concepts are not derived from this worldly sense data, if they are innate or they're revelations from God, then there is no way to take them back to sense data in this world. And then you'd have to face Plato's conclusion. The only way to justify a concept is to connect it somehow to its source in another supernatural world, which is exactly Plato's philosophy. You'd have to have an intuition of the supernatural forms or universals to which our ideas are supposed to correspond, and that's led him directly to mysticism and total non-objectivity. So if we're ever going to reach a method of guiding our consciousness, which will enable us to keep on track and adhere to this reality, it has to involve a method of taking ideas back to sensory data, which presupposes that we have discovered that ideas come from sense experience. And this, of course, is an induction. All ideas as such, derive from sense experience. So how do we induce the principle? Now, you can't derive it from the, quote, definition of a concept. You can't say, oh, well, that's easy. Concept is an integration of percept, so obviously it has to come from a percept. And why can't you do that? Because we don't have that definition yet. We have to first discover that there is a relationship between concepts and percepts, that one comes from the other, and Aristotle was the man who discovered this and thereby made possible one day Ayn Rand's definition of what is a concept. But how did he discover it? He had to watch directly the process he used in forming concepts. That was a direct observation. Once the distinction was made, he then had to discover by watching himself form concepts. And he was the first person in history to identify what the essential process was, and he called it abstraction. by which he meant, in effect, a specialized focus on the similarities among things, for instance, among tables, while ignoring their differences. One is tall, one is short, and one is long, and one is narrow, and one is red, and one is green, but they all have certain similarities which we can focus on, which we can pull out. That's what Latin abstract, separate out in thought. And as he put it, what we did when we formed a concept is to separate in thought that which couldn't be separated in reality. In reality, the similarities are embedded in a whole bunch of differences, but we can separate them in thought and find a universal running through all tables, and that enables us to form the concept. Or the concept red, which we can think with or think about apart from the specific things which are red, so we can pull it out abstracted, but it can't exist apart from those things. Now, Aristotle simply performed this process of abstraction and observed it each time on various concepts, and then he watched other people and reconstructed what they had to have done, and he concluded, he induced, this is how we form general ideas. He had a range of all the different kinds of concepts and the quantity of instances, and he led to the inductive conclusion. The formation of ideas is a process of abstraction. It's not, as Plato said, a process of recollection. And that, of course, led him deductively now to the conclusion there are no ideas are possible apart from sensory data. And that is what led to the perennial conflict between the Platonist idea of innate ideas and Aristotle's what they call empiricism, that everything is based on sensory observation. That's all based on an induction, a generalization, from observing 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 100 concepts being formed from sensory experience and then generalizing. Now, you might think that it's, could he really arrive at the idea of abstraction simply by observing his own mental processes? Well, it certainly is a feat of fantastic genius, but I don't know of anything discovered earlier that led him to this, beyond the distinctions that we've talked about. And I think that if you're a total genius, this is possible. My final proof to myself is the story of how Ayn Rand discovered that the essence of abstraction is measurement omission, which, of course, was her idea, not Aristotle's. And she tells that story in IOE, and we will look at that next time. But basically, she just introspected when somebody said to her, well, what is abstraction? She was puzzled, and it took her, what, half hour or 40 minutes or something? She said, oh, yeah, that's what I do. And that is, in essence, what Aristotle did, but on a more basic level. He didn't get to the anatomy of abstraction because he had to first get to the idea of mental separation. So anyway, Aristotle concluded, an inductive conclusion, all ideas are formed by abstraction, going back ultimately to sense data. And he even knew there were higher level abstractions from abstractions. You know, he had a whole series of them worked out, from table and chair to furniture, etc., all the way up to entity as the broadest in that particular chain. And of course, now we take for granted that abstraction is how we reach concepts. And so when we started, if you remember in the second class, reason is our means of survival. So what is reason? I said, well, we may not know very much, but we know that it involves abstraction, you see. So we could take that as an inductive starting point, thanks to Aristotle, having gone through this whole incredible development thousands of years ago, so that even the uneducated person now can say it's, quote, common sense. But you see, all of the things, this might reassure some of the people who are afraid of starting with common sense, that we take as common sense, we ultimately have to go back and generate also from reality, but you can't do it all at the beginning. But that's what the purpose of a whole system is, that at the end of the system, when you've finished all your inductions, there is nothing that hasn't been taken back to reality. But you can't do that at the very outset. That's for the people who are still asking me questions because they're bothered by starting with certain common sense values. It's just like on this process of abstraction. So we know that ideas are abstractions from sense data. They therefore must be traceable. They therefore... I stop when there is some explosion on this telephone. They therefore must be traceable back to sense data. And that is an indispensable element in what will one day become Aristotle's discovery of logic. Basically, he's going to discover that logic is a method of taking an idea back to sensory data and thereby making it incontestable. So you see now why it had to be the same philosopher who rejected innate ideas, regarded sense perception as valid, and discovered logic. Those all have to go together. And even though Plato anticipated logic in many ways, he couldn't have discovered logic because he rejected the principle of testing ideas by sense data. He didn't think sense data were infallible. On the contrary, he thought they were tainted. And he didn't think ideas came from them. So he was barred. The only way he could test ideas was by reference to a supernatural realm. And if you want to know his method, in the Republic, the divided line was the steps you validated an idea, not by coming down from abstractions to this world, but by going up from sensory observations and ending with one all-unifying burst of intuition. But Aristotle, of course, took the opposite path, this world and everything starting with the senses. Now, there's a lot of things he didn't know. He didn't know about measurement, omission, or the crow epistemology, and so on. But he made all of these later discoveries possible by inducing the crucial point that ideas come from sense experience. Now, if you want to put this in the form, basically where we are now, in the form of a genus, I don't find this particular application of the genus particularly helpful in telling us how to induce, but it's good. It just helps to lay out where we are. I would say that the principle here is that knowledge, or at least knowledge above the level of a jellyfish, which only has discrete sensations, knowledge requires certification by percepts. I think for anything to be knowledge, it has to be validated by perception, sense perception. And then I would say that breaks down into two subdivisions. The animals do this directly. All of their knowledge is in the form of directly validated grasp of reality, direct percepts. But man's distinctive method, being conceptual, is not by having percepts, but by reducing his concepts to percepts. So there's two different ways of certifying your knowledge by percepts, by directly having the percepts, and that's all. Or, of course, man has perception, but insofar as it's his knowledge is conceptual, he has to reduce it back to percepts. And that's the two ways you come under the principle that knowledge is certified by percepts. And then, of course, once you know that reduction to percepts is the essence of conceptual cognition, you are on the track to establishing logic. In fact, you know right there that you need a method then, because it's not just a given that you sit and wait. You have to do something to your concepts, and what you do is figure out a way to bring them back to percepts. So from just that subdivision, we can say why logic, why a method is necessary. Now we got to get to the actual discovery of logic. even granted we know the general source of ideas, we still need to discover certain things about the way our minds actually use ideas before we can start to think of a guide and what that guide could be. Now, the main discovery here, I think, was made much before Plato and Aristotle, but made by the Greeks, required someone simply to pay attention to what people do with concepts and what they had done for centuries before there was any epistemology. And in a word, what they did is argue. Now, I don't mean by argument a fight, but a structure. In other words, they didn't simply deal with or renounce a single idea or a single statement. They connect one idea to another and use the combination to lead to still another. And by about the 5th century BC, and probably even earlier, the Greeks had an explicit grasp of the concept of premise leading to a conclusion, and that combination constituting an argument. So-and-so, so-and-so, therefore so-and-so. They knew that this was reasoning. They had that term. And that reasoning was, if not the form, at least one crucial form of using ideas to gain knowledge. Now, obviously, many observations and inductive conclusions were required to get to concepts such as arguments, conclusions, premises, etc. But we have to take that for granted here. The Greeks had also observed explicitly by the time of Plato that you can take an argument back step by step, asking what a given premise depends on and what that depends on, etc. So they had grasped not only the idea of an argument, but of a chain or sequence of arguments. Now, the big debate was what the chain went back to. According to Plato, the chain takes you back to a mystic source, but that's not relevant. They did have the idea of a sequence, one argument built on another. And this, by the way, was the form in which the Greeks grasped what Ayn Rand calls the relational and hierarchical views of knowledge. It was the early form of grasping these ideas. They grasped that knowledge is relational because they realized that the way you gain crucial knowledge is by connecting or relating one cognitive item to another, and not just by staring at it in a void. And they grasped that it was hierarchical because they realized that these relationships among ideas can be built into complex, lengthy structures going back to some kind of origin or starting point on which is built a later, and then a later, etc. So this much about our use of ideas and the nature of knowledge, the 5th century Greeks knew perfectly well. Now, if we take everything Aristotle figured out about concepts, plus this whole knowledge about argumentation and the structure of reasoning, that is the context in which Aristotle discovered logic. Now let's see if we can reduce, given this, what he had to discover in what order. First we'll go backwards and then do it forward to get from just the general knowledge that we've got so far back specifically to logic. What do you need to discover to culminate in the idea of logic? And here I think the structure is fairly straightforward. What logic does is enable you fully to validate or prove an idea by showing you how to establish valid relationships leading all the way back to axioms or sensory data. So then the question becomes, how does he discover the idea of validation leading all the way back to sensory data? Well, obviously that presupposes that he's discovered what is the principle of validity. What is it that makes an argument valid? And only then can he say Well, now I know what makes an argument valid. A chain of valid arguments is then constitute a proof. See? So we have to discover the basic principle of validity. But how are we going to discover the basic principle of validity? Obviously, we're going to have to segregate a bunch of valid arguments on one side and a bunch of invalid ones on the other by some means, and then we can abstract what is it that's common to all the valid ones. So the next, the earlier step will have to be, there's 8, 10, 20, whatever examples of valid argument as against invalid, and what makes the difference? And then we can step back and say, now we know all these are valid, what is the principle of validity? And now, and then we can go on to proof. And then the question is, before we can even segregate valid from invalid, we're going to need to realize consciously we have to find rules to guide us in relating or combining ideas. Now, all we've said so far in the earlier discussion of objectivity is we need some kind of method to validate our concepts. But this is a more specific point now. We have to go from just we need a general guide for the conceptual faculty to we need to discover rules to direct us when we specifically combine ideas to reach a conclusion. That's what led to logic. See, Aristotle was not too good in giving you rules in forming concepts. What he did focus on, and that really you didn't get to Ayn Rand, what he did is say once you put concepts into statements and draw a conclusion from premises, we need rules to guide us in combining propositions into a conclusion. That's what he was able to get to from grasping that concepts need a method. And so the going in the reverse order, he first had to discover the need for specific rules to direct us in combining statements to reach a conclusion. And then segregate the valid ones from the invalid. And then abstract what's the basic principle of validity and then tie it all up into proof is this cascading structure of valid arguments all the way back to sense data. That's the four steps that I see. So we had already, I don't know how many steps, and now we've got a whole bunch more steps to get from the generalized idea that we need a method to specifically logic. So let's start with, how do you discover that you need rules to direct you in combining propositions to reach a conclusion? Which is already a big step. It's not obvious simply in saying, well, concepts are capable of error, interpretation is capable of error, and the senses are not. That does not yet tell you. When you put together statements to a conclusion, you need rules. So you've got to focus on that. What did we have to learn about arguments to realize we need rules to guide us? Well, the Greeks knew long before Aristotle that some conclusions followed from the premises that were given and some didn't. The Sophists, for example, were famous for constructing arguments that tricked people into accepting a conclusion, even though it didn't really follow from the premises. And moreover, philosophers from Thales on regularly criticized each other by saying, you are drawing an unwarranted conclusion, or you are repudiating in your conclusion the very thing you stated in your premise. In other words, because man is a rational being and can and does reason way before the discovery of epistemology, the Greeks before Aristotle had discovered that reasoning was the form of learning, or a crucial form of learning, and that a person's reasoning could go wrong and he could be criticized for it. They knew this before the discovery of logic. In other words, they could grasp non sequiturs before there was any study of when does something follow and when does it not. Just as children today can be logical in any given instance or grasp that something doesn't follow before learning about logic. And this is basically how Aristotle discovered the need and the possibility of a method of guiding the process of reasoning. He knew it was necessary because he knew the mind can go wrong. This is not simply the direct observation of the self-evident, where no error can occur. And he knew it was possible because this was the area where we had choice and control and weren't merely reactors. Consequently, if you're a genius and he sees that arguments go wrong and they go right and nobody knows why or how to explain it, he says to himself, I want to find a universal method to guide, regulate, check the whole flow of ideas in our consciousness. I want to formulate a set of rules or principles such that if an argument obeys these rules, then the conclusion follows. And if not, it doesn't. The argument is invalid. Now, you can just imagine he sets himself the assignment to abstract a method of thought about everything, no matter what the content is. Ships, shoes, sealing wax, doesn't make any difference. Cabbages and kings. You can't describe it. That is ineffable in terms of the mammoth stature of what he's doing. And it's the analog or the counterpart in epistemology of what he did in metaphysics. In metaphysics, he looked for the laws of being qua being. What were the principles of everything that existed by virtue of the fact that it existed? And now he's asking the companion question in cognition. What are the principles that govern valid thought, qua valid thought, no matter what is the subject matter? Now, this is a process of induction that could never again be equaled in originality and scale, because he's taken in the totality on both of the fundamental branches of philosophy. And so no one could ever equal Aristotle. And Ayn Rand was, of course, the first one to say this, and she was very indignant if anybody said, well, Aristotle made some suggestions, but you, Ayn Rand, are really the genius. She really did not like that, because she thought that means the person is very superficial and they don't realize that Aristotle, but in one lifetime, asked the most fundamental questions in the most universal form and gave the right answers to both, and without which, you know, we would still be floundering in a pre-scientific, pre-industrial civilization. Now, I just want to get the plug in here that his discovery of the need of the finding these rules was itself inductive. How does he know that we need it in every case? Because he said, every case of reasoning, in every such case, we're fallible and volitional. Now, he couldn't examine every case of reasoning. He examined a whole number and a whole range, and he had no problem saying, this is universal, although that's a generalization beyond anyone's ability to establish by inspection. You can't inspect every case, and you can't reach it by deduction either. You can only reach it by observing. We are fallible and volitional in this case, and this, and this, and this. We need a rule, therefore. We need it in every case, because every case is going to be like this. Now, we want to find, what are these rules? We have to somehow distinguish the valid from the invalid. And that means his discovery of the actual rules of logic as against just of the need to discover the rules. Now that he sees the need, you see the complexity here of what he had to go through. Now, I'm not going to take you here into the specific rules that he discovered, because you would need I'll have a whole course of logic on that, and that's the prior analytics if you ever want to read it. But he goes through every type of argument inductively to come to the conclusion of which ones are valid and which ones are not. But the only point I want to tell you here is the crucial thing that he discovered is that all the valid combinations are an issue of form, not of matter or content. As is put, validity is a formal issue. It depends on the structure of the argument, not on its subject. And Aristotle was the first to discover that, without which it would be impossible to discover logic, because you'd have one set of rules for tomatoes and another set for peaches and so on. But he said, no, it has nothing to do with the subject matter. It has to do with the structure. Certain structures are logically valid, that is, the conclusion follows, no matter what the content. And certain structures are inherently invalid, no matter what the content. Now, I just give you, those of you who don't know any logic, an example. Here is a valid structure, or an example of a valid one. Socrates is a man. Men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal. And if you symbolize that, it would be S is M, M is P, therefore S is P. Now, anything that follows that structure is valid. And in fact, the medievals collected all the structures, every structure that is valid within syllogistic reasoning, and gave it a name. And that one happens to be Barbara, for a reason which you can find out if you read history. On the other hand, take this argument. Socrates is mortal, true. Pigs are mortal, true. Therefore, Socrates is a pig. Now, there is S is M, P is M, therefore S is P. And that does not fall. That's invalid in every possible usage. And you see, it's simply a matter of the structure, regardless of what the S, the M, and the P stand for. So then the question becomes, how did Aristotle discover that validity is an issue of form? Because that's the heart of his ability to discover the rules of logic. Now, in my opinion, and I'm basically giving an opinion because I don't know how I would prove this, but I think it's just too easy to say, well, he just observed this fact in many cases and generalized, because this is a very esoteric fact that had never before been dreamt of or noticed. There's no record anywhere of anybody ever grasping this. Now, I think there were two predisposing factors here. Two things that Aristotle had going for him in the form of earlier knowledge that led him to grasp this amazing fact that validity is purely formal. First, the fact that mathematics, and specifically geometry, as a deductive system, was already well developed. And I think this was a crucial model if anyone was ever to reach logic. Logic is so abstract, you would need something less abstract as a guide. And geometry was the model of a perfect deductive system with definite rules regarding how you approach the subject matter, what you start with, the axioms, and how to go with absolute rigor, each step following inevitably from the preceding and ending with QED, you know, quad erat demonstrandum. This is what I have to prove. That's proven now. Now, he grasped, Aristotle grasped, that geometric reasoning was possible only because geometry deals with abstractions, not with concretes. You can come to conclusions about equilateral triangles, but you cannot come in geometry as part of your theorem to a conclusion about a triangle that's 3 inches on each side and then 3.2 inches, etc. And this must have predisposed Aristotle to conclude that when we make logical connections about anything, we make them according to very abstract rules, not according to rules specifying concretes. Math gave to Aristotle the idea that what he's looking for is an abstract science of method, but that it has to be even more abstract than geometry, since it's now not restricted even to shapes or quantity, but has to cover all thought. And the way Aristotle formulated that, he said, necessity links universals. In other words, only the broad abstractions can he find necessary rules explaining validity. But second, the other thing that I think predisposed him to this is that if you know his philosophy, his whole philosophy in every branch and issue rests on the distinction between form and matter. On there's almost no issue in Aristotle that he doesn't approach in terms of a thing has a stuff in a certain structure or organization. And he's not always correct, and that's not always helpful, but it's incredibly brilliant the way he can analyze everything from God to the soul to the basic elements of the physical world to the nature of sense experience, to every crucial philosophic issue in terms of form and matter. You'd have to take a whole course in Aristotle to see how he did that. So, given that, and that itself is a legacy of earlier philosophers in the elements of form and matter that he combined, but what could be more natural to him than to apply it to thought also? So he just went about very straightforwardly dividing every argument into form and matter. In other words, its structure versus its specific content. And he proceeded to analyze all the possibilities that he could think of, that's the issue of range, and that he found that in each type of case, the validity was independent of the matter and dependent only on the form. And on that basis, he induced the conclusion and thus reached the concept of formal validity. That is validity through the form, and that was the discovery of logic. And to put it another way, he abstracted the common pattern of all valid arguments in contrast to invalid ones. And hereafter, the human race had an explicit and defensible method by which to guide and check their reasoning. It was no longer a question of, well, this strikes me as okay, or somebody saying, well, it just doesn't strike me, I don't believe it. It was the first time that reasoning was brought within our conscious, deliberate understanding and control, so that people, that is not yet the end of the job. It's a big, huge step, but it's not at the end, because we haven't still found the one in the many, the culminating induction, and no beak. Philosopher will allow a whole pile of valid arguments and just say, well, what the hell, there's 27, you know, today they would do that proudly. They'd say, we don't want to, you know, be simplistic, there's 39 valid arguments and 87 invalid ones, and then they'd let it go at that. But the Greeks wouldn't dream of such a thing, so Aristotle now has to say, what is common to all of the valid forms? What is the basic principle that defines validity in every one of these valid forms? Now he's segregated them all out. So what is the one form that unites all of these? And of course, this is where he came up with what is the one thing that makes them all valid? And he found that, which was completely unknown before, that in every case of invalid reasoning, the same mistake was in some way committed, namely a contradiction, a violation of what he called the law of non-contradiction, which the law of non-contradiction said nothing can be A and non-A at the same time and in the same respect. And every time there was invalid reasoning, somebody was saying, here's a thing which is A and non-A at the same time and in the same respect. No matter which the form, whether it was Barber or any one of the others, they always remained true to the law of contradiction. Whereas, every time it was invalid, he would show that involved a contradiction. For instance, if somebody says all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore, Socrates is not mortal. You're saying all men are mortal and here's one who isn't. It's A and non-A. And that's a contradiction. Now, this was a vast induction, far beyond the observed cases. I mean, nobody could, to this day, you can't go through every argument because there's millions of them that haven't even been uttered yet. But He went through the broad enough range in instances that he was perfectly content to generalize. That is the basic principle of all valid reasoning. Now, Aristotle, of course, himself pretty much restricted his own discoveries to deductive reasoning, but the law of contradiction or non-contradiction is basic to all forms of reasoning, actually, including induction also. So even though he didn't have much to say about induction, it applies there as well. So my point here is not that he discovered the truth of the law of non-contradiction. That, I'm sure, long preceded his discovery of logic. What I'm saying is important here is that he discovered the law's role in reasoning. That is the principle governing all of our thought sequences. Now, the role of the law in thinking is not deducible. Is not deducible from anything. It's not deducible from the definition of knowledge. It's not even deducible from the statement of the law. From the fact that nothing can be a contradiction, you can't conclude that what invalidates all invalid reasoning is the attempt to create a contradiction. That in no way follows. And believe me, if you think it's self-evident, you try to teach logic to a group of freshmen, and they don't have any case. Of course, ASA. What's that got to do with anything? And they haven't the faintest clue that that has anything to do with guiding your reasoning. So this is a definite discovery. And it's only by observing countless cases and the specific rules of reasoning that he'd already reached and abstracting from them that he could see that in every case and every rule, it all comes down to the same thing, so he could induce and thus universalize his discovery. So the paradox here is that Aristotle, who is accused always of being a narrow-minded rationalist, a champion of deduction who does not appreciate induction, actually discovered the nature and rules of deduction by a series of staggering and original inductions. So he was a master in the practice of induction, and he used it to reach the rules of deduction. So to point to him as the father of logic and say, oh, well, he only knew deduction, is ridiculous. He didn't discuss the theory of induction, but he was the greatest inducer of all time, bar none. So I always think that is the most grotesque injustice to say Aristotle didn't know anything about induction. We needed Francis Bacon, you know, is what they say, which is, you know, like, I don't know. You can't compare Aristotle and Francis Bacon in the same evening, let alone the same sentence. Now, this, by the way, is a further proof of the role of induction in cognition and in philosophy. Induction is necessary to grasp the rules of deduction. Just as induction from countless instances of itself is necessary to grasp the rules of induction. How do you think we're ever going to reach the principles of proper induction except by inducing from specific inductions, which is what we're trying to do in these seminars? My idea is to, in this course, but specifically in the next, the companion, is having done 10 or 15 inductions to abstract and induce what are the rules of induction that govern all inductions. See, but we have to have each of these becomes a concrete, and then we're going to try to induce what is induction more thoroughly in the next course. All right, so now we are ready to go on to the final point. We now know clearly what is a valid argument, but what is full validation? In other words, proof. We could say all men are geniuses. Mr. Jones, a freshman, is a man, therefore he's a genius. That's a valid argument. In other words, given those premises, the conclusion follows, but it's certainly not proved. Why? Because the premise is certainly false or debatable, as against all men are mortal. So we have to then come to grasp that the full validation, or what we call now the proof, consists of establishing valid relationships going all the way back to sensory data. In other words, the need to take your premises back to axioms, axioms being just statements of the perceptually self-evident. Now, Aristotle was the father of logic, and he understood perfectly well that, you know, that fruit salad example that I use in Opar is not a proof of anything and is not logic. You know, I made that up because that's what the moderns think is logic. Apples are razors, oranges are blades, and therefore you can shave with fruit salad. That is the modern conception of logic. You can say anything you want in your premises, and it's perfectly logical as long as a conclusion follows. Now, Aristotle, who discovered logic, understood that the purpose of logic was to conform our thinking to reality, which requires taking ideas back without contradiction to sensory data. And that's how he originated the concept of logical proof. You have to go back step by step to axioms. Otherwise, logic wouldn't be a guide to reality. It wouldn't have anything to do with objectivity. It would be simply a type of chess game, a way of preserving internal consistency among arbitrary statements, which means it would have nothing to do with cognition, which is exactly what the moderns, Bertrand Russell types, do with it. So we've reached the idea now of adherence to reality in gaining knowledge by our choice through the use of this method of proof going backwards till we reach axioms. In other words, through the use of logic, remembering that the governing principle has to be non-contradiction. Now you see how much, in other words, we've reached Aristotle's concept of objectivity. And now we can go back to look at the original dictionary definition, which was, seems to be so obvious, not affected by personal feelings, based on facts. Well, how in the world would they ever even get to that? They have to, if it's not feelings, and it's not just percepts, then it's got to be something else. What? And how does that other thing get to facts? How is it reducible, and what are the rules? The whole incredible development required to then be able just to say, set your personal feelings aside with the idea, well, of course, use the method of logic, you know, reducing your complex ideas back to, but they don't put any of that in the definition. They just say, not affected by personal feelings. And it gives you an idea of the enormous context that had to be required, the massive discoveries that people have just no idea about, no idea at all. Even like many objectivists think, well, we need something to correct because we're capable of error, so we follow the laws of logic. I mean, as though one follows from the other when just omitting such a massive development. Now, we haven't really finished with objectivity, although we have with this lecture, because we still need a contrast. Remember, you always have to have a contrast. We haven't taken all the ways of departing from reality volitionally and put them under one concept as the contrast to objectivity. In other words, we haven't mentioned the concept of subjectivism. Now, that's the only contrast that was possible to Aristotle. When you get to the objectivist development, then we have three concepts here: objective, intrinsic, subjective. But of course, the concept of intrinsicist was invented by Ayn Rand. It was unknown to the Greeks. The very concept was unknown, and Aristotle himself was an intrinsicist, so they could only contrast it to subjectivism. Now, what would Aristotle's definition of subjectivism be within the context that, as a contrast? Well, instead of volitional adherence to reality, he would have to grasp in some terms volitional indifference to reality or divergence from reality. And instead of by the use of logic, it would have to be by the disdain of logic. And then he has to fill in the various examples he knows of where people take as their rule something other than or opposed to logic and thereby departed from reality. And the obvious example that he knew about was going by emotion in cognitive issues. And in his list of fallacies, he clearly recognized that this is a departure from logic and therefore from reality. And in fact, he listed a whole bunch of different fallacies of appealing to different kinds of emotions. Now, if he had known about Judaism and Christianity, he would have got the idea of the reliance on authority as another form of subjectivism, but that was very uncommon in Greece. It's not like there were no fundamentalists in Greece that I know of, and it ultimately reduces to feeling anyway. So what you'd have to do to get the concept of subjectivity would be you observe case after case of people being non-logical or anti-logical, and then you induce the principle if you use something other than logic, you can't claim adherence to reality. And that is subjectivism and therefore invalid. Now, this gives you an indication of the immense inductive processes across centuries and all, you know, refined and developed further by Aristotle's disciples behind such a self-evident statement as Jack Webb's fabulous statement from the old Dragnet, just give us the facts, man. I mean, imagine what was required to get to the state of a whole culture which understood that and what it means practically and what, you know, the method is of doing it and what the alternative is, and yet people just take it for granted. When you, as objectivists, say feelings are not tools of cognition, you can thank Aristotle, even Plato and Aristotle, for that, because once you say tool of cognition, you already have the idea method of acquiring knowledge and the incredible development that was required to grasp such a thing. If you say just because you or your group believe it, that doesn't make it so, or just because you dreamt it, that doesn't make it so, or that's the I wish versus the it is, all of that is a restatement of Aristotle's concept of objectivity. And of course, this is the necessary precursor of modern science and therefore of the Industrial Revolution and, of course, of objectivism. There could be no such thing as a systematically logical philosophy before the discovery of logic and objectivity. It would be impossible to apply norms deliberately before the norms were discovered. So Aristotle made possible the whole development. If Ayn Rand had lived at that time and had used her genius, the most she could have done would be to discover what Aristotle discovered, and then he would have to reverse history and let Aristotle, when he finally arrived, discover objectivism. But I say this because I get so exasperated by objectivists who say, but Aristotle didn't grasp this point properly. Don't we see it so much better than him? That always makes my blood stop cold, that anybody could be that ahistorical and ungrateful in the face of what this one man achieved. Now, you can gauge the state of the world today by the extent to which people feel that anything that occurs in astrology, UFOs, ecology, well, that's my opinion. And in a democracy, I can believe what I want. This is a free country. Logic is just semantics. There is no objectivity. How can we ever know the truth or be sure of anything? And you can see, I think, why Ayn Rand reacted, not simply with disagreement, but with anger and disgust at those statements, because what she saw them as doing is total nihilism, destroying, slapping down 2,000 years of painstaking discoveries built on Aristotle, and here are these utterly ignorant, pretentious, presumptuous moderns trying to reduce us to pre-philosophic, mindless tribalists, which is the meaning of all those statements, and that's what they're leading to, even if most of the people who spout them have no idea of it. Now, that brings me to the end of what I want to say about Aristotle. And what I want to do next time, I have a whole bunch of written questions, but before I get to them, I want to give you your topic for next time. And that is, I've titled it, Objectivity from Aristotle to Ayn Rand. Now, how do you get, by what series of inductions do you get from Aristotle's idea of objectivity, adherence to reality by following the method of logic, to Ayn Rand's definition of objectivity? Now, I'll give you my definition of Ayn Rand's definition. In other words, this is what I think is the substance of her concept, although this is my wording. It's in Opar, page 117. Volitional adherence to reality by following certain rules of method, a method based on facts and appropriate to man's form of cognition. Volitional adherence to reality by following certain rules of method, a method based on facts and appropriate to man's form of cognition. Now, this is not as different from Aristotle as it might sound, because the method Ayn Rand advocates is Aristotelian logic. Nevertheless, there's a number of fundamental epistemological discoveries embodied in this formulation which have profound theoretical and practical significance. So I thought that having given that much time to objectivity, we may as well bring it up to the objectivist concept, and that'll basically cover what we're going to do on epistemology in this course, and that's the assignment for next week. Starting with, or granting that we know, Aristotle's concept of objectivity, how would you reach Ayn Rand's concept? What did she have to induce, given that she knew his? So she already knew logic, she knew the need of a method, she knew all that. Everything we've done so far, she knew, the whole West knew. So, but then she had to do something and discover something, and since all philosophic discoveries are inductive, she had to arrive at some inductions to reach hers. Now, I want to give you some clues, so you won't be totally swimming, only partially. And then that's going to be our subject next time. I would like to also to get some questions in today, so I have to choose between being murky about the clues and have some time for questions, or being really clear about the clues and have no time for questions. So it's a, using Aristotle's terminology, the golden mean here between unclarity and no questions. Aristotle thought that it's enough for objectivity to go back to direct sense perception. Because for him, he had a certain theory of concepts, that our mind was basically completely blank, it contributed nothing to the process of cognition, except it was like a blank slate on which experience wrote, and then we could selectively focus, etc. Now, for Ayn Rand, concepts are partly human. Our mind is not just a blank slate, and therefore, objectivity has to incorporate this element. You know, if you go back to the definition that I just gave you, It's following certain rules of method. Now, Aristotle would say, a method based on facts, period. But she added, and appropriate to man's form of cognition. Now, why is that important? What did she have to learn to realize that objectivity can't simply say based on facts, but has to include appropriate to man's form of cognition? Now, obviously, this rested on what earlier discovery of hers? She had to have some theory of concepts and concept formation that led her to realize that objectivity involves both facts and the mind, both reality and man's consciousness. And she did come to a theory of concept formation, which then led to her definition of objectivity. So then becomes the question, how did she reach her theory of concept formation? Well, I told you she just looked inward. But she couldn't do that at 8 or 10 or 12 or 14. So what observations about knowledge were necessary to get her ready? What inductions did she have to make to reach the point where she could then discover concept formation so she could then amend or elaborate the theory of objectivity? So I put to you that there's a three-step process here, each with parts, but the first is she had to learn a lot about knowledge beyond only what Aristotle knew in order to be ripe to grasp a new theory of concept formation. In fact, I think there's four things she had to learn about knowledge. And I think you can even reduce her theory of concepts and show that to reach this theory of concept formation, you have to know these four things. You can even figure out an order. And then you reach the concept formation theory on that basis is the second main thing. And then you simply now look at the issue of objectivity with this theory of concept formation and put it together. Now, I should probably give you some clues as to some of the things that you'd have to know in a preliminary way to be prepared to grasp concept formation. So I'm just going to give you a certain clue, a couple of clues here, and then I'll give you a whole formal reduction next time, but just to give you something to go with, because this is so abstract. Well, concept formation obviously involves sequences, one step and then the next, one concept and then built onto it the next concept. So you would first have to be very clear that knowledge in general terms has to follow a certain order. And I think that is one direct set of observations and an induction, and probably the earliest. Now, I'll give you another clue. She wants to conclude that concepts are a form of integration. Well, obviously, she had to have some awareness of integration as being crucial to knowledge in general. And that's another series of observations. And as a matter of fact, Harry Binswanger has unearthed a paper that she wrote in 1961 where she defined concept as a mental symbol and then crossed out the word symbol and replaced it by integration. So this grasp of integration as a crucial conscious process, crucial cognitive process, is another thing she had to grasp, and I think there's evidence of how you grasp that, and that she did from an earlier stage. And one more clue I'll give you. Since concepts are going to be defined in terms of measurement, and that's the key to their ability to transcend, go beyond percepts, you also have to know something about how measurement enables you to transcend percepts if you're then going to explain concepts in terms of measurement. And should I give you one last clue? Because I think there's four things in this preliminary stage. She's going to conclude that even though concepts are permeated by the human element, they nevertheless are objective. They give us reality. So she's obviously going to have some idea that the fact that consciousness has identity does not prevent it from knowing reality, that that's the means, not the obstacle to cognition. So I'll give you just those four clues. Try to figure out how you would learn those four things before you know the theory of concept formation. And then on that basis, how you would reach the theory of concept formation. And then on that basis, how you would tie it into objectivity and amend the concept of objectivity. And I actually think that's an intelligible clue. It's very abstract, but the next class will consist of trying to go through it step by step, and I'll try to give you the reduction in a little more organized fashion, but I felt I have to give you something to go on here, or you will... I would drown if somebody just said, here's Aristotle's concept of objectivity, now go home and recreate Ayn Rand's inductions, because that's a nightmare topic. Now we have about 7 plus 4, 11 or 12 minutes, and I got a lot of questions this week, which is good, but I'm torn between, therefore, brief answers or leaving some out, and I hate to leave them out, so I want to try to be reasonably brief. Reading only those paragraphs or passages which are crucial to the question. Does rationalism... So draw a line. This is now not on objectivity anymore. In fact, I tried to arrange them in order of the lectures so far. And the first one's going to be on rationalism. Does rationalism come in kinds? Isn't there an important distinction between a groping inductivist who retains remnants of rationalism because he doesn't have a clearly grasped method, as against a methodologically consistent, committed to deduction rationalist? In other words, rationalism by default versus rationalism by method. Or is it all just a matter of degrees? Well, I think there's a big difference in motive between the two types that you're discussing, and therefore in the scale of the problem, the scope of it, and in the curability of it. Some people do it by default, by the just absorbing, this is what clarity and logic and comprehensiveness consists of, and then they're open, though, they want the truth. But then there are people like Kant, for example, for whom rationalism is a way of methodically avoiding reality and of creating your own super reality, your own little world. In that case, that is radically different. That kind of committed anti-perceptual mentality, I mean opposed to percepts, as the base of knowledge, is essentially different, morally and epistemologically. Now, when you say, is it all just a matter of degrees, I would say, yes, only in the sense of rationalism is rationalism no matter what your method is. So insofar as you are deducing without reference to the concretes of reality, you're committing the same error. But there are curable and... honest cases of it, and then it's a total disease. Now a question on reduction. You seem to do reduction by taking a definition and then taking some key parts of it and breaking it down. How do you know what parts of the definition to choose? And then he says, I tried to do this, and I can't do it. So my answer is, I do not take some key parts of the definition arbitrarily. I pick not every word in the definition, but every philosophic essential in the definition, and reduce those. And I have a sharp distinction in my mind. What is a philosophic concept, and what is just a common concept? Now, for instance, if I were to say, in regard to justice, it's a deserved recompense, a deserved reward or punishment. And the principle I want to induce is that this is important. I would not try to reduce the word important, because important is, there's 10,000 synonyms, and it just means pay attention to this. It means what it means in ordinary life. You don't need, if you're not in aesthetic theory, any special reduction for that. But if you're saying deserved, I know from the history of philosophy that a big question is what is deserved and who deserves what and what does that concept mean? And the same thing is true, reward and punishment. Why are they important? Now, maybe I'm going by the fact that I pick all the words that are the bone of contention among philosophers through the ages. Perhaps that's what is guiding me. Although when we did reason as man's means of survival, I picked reason and survival, even though it's obvious, but I picked means of survival because I know that that it's a crucial philosophic point that a living organism has to have a means of survival. So you could say that I'm not picking some words, I'm picking all the words that I think are philosophically fraught with significance, because those are the ones that we're going to have to validate. We don't have to validate or recreate the ordinary framework of vocabulary. So, for instance, to take one more example, if egoism is the idea that you should be the ultimate beneficiary, I don't have to define what I mean by you or the actor. But I do have to define what is beneficiary, because that's the whole thing hinges on that, and the whole question is who is going to be the beneficiary and what is the standard of beneficial. So I guess the real answer to your question is from 30 or 40 years of studying the history of philosophy, I have a total antenna for when is something a word on which everything is going to hinge and when isn't it. And whenever one of those words comes up in the definition, that's what I immediately say has to be reduced or validate it. I don't know if that helps you. That's the best I can do. Now a question on cause and effect. Given the inductive proof of causality in Lecture 1, how do we dismiss out of hand claims that causality is inapplicable to new areas that were not covered in the original induction? For example, subatomic particles. We didn't, you know, include subatomic particles, so why can't somebody say, well, all you've got is a generalization, and I've come up with an exception to it, and therefore your inductive proof is overthrown. And then he goes on, is the answer that the burden of proof is on the claimant to specify in what way subatomic particles are different from all the things we sampled in our original induction? Because in our original induction, we sampled big things and little things, and we saw that size was irrelevant to the principle of causality. And therefore, the fact that subatomic particles are particularly tiny in itself gives no grounds to think causality is inapplicable to them. I think that's perfectly good reasoning. But I want to clarify one other implication. You said, given our inductive proof of causality, we're not in a position of dismissing a contradiction to it. And the implication would be, well, if we had deduced it, we would have proved that it's necessary. And therefore, since it has to be so, this can't violate it. But the truth is that inductive conclusions are necessary. If they're truths at all, they're metaphysically necessary. And once we establish it with an appropriate range and integration with what is, to our knowledge, the basic law of reality, A is A, you can't say, well, it's just contingent. That's just what you've discovered so far. Certainly, the burden is on the person to say, what is it about subatomic particles that violates everything we know? Because we've tied it into everything we know, including the basic law of reality. Now, the person is going to be really trapped in this case because in every case where we delimit or correct or amend an earlier formulation, say, well, it's not true in every case, it's only true in these cases, it's because we specify there are new circumstances at work here that we hadn't identified before. But what do we mean by new circumstances? New causal conditions that are applicable here that weren't before. Now, what is this guy going to come up with? What is the new causal factor that is going to invalidate causality? This is in complete contradiction. It's like saying, I've discovered an area that you didn't know before that violates the law of identity, and here's the identity of the thing that enabled me to grasp that it isn't anything. So it's an impossibility if we accept the integration of knowledge. That's what I would say. And I wouldn't, the very fact that you're tempted, well, since it's just inductive, it doesn't have to be so we're wide open, is itself, it seems to me, a lapse back into a rationalist way of looking at it. Now, I want to see if there's any one more one here in the last minute. Oh, I can't find... Oh, that's capital punishment. I can't... This person's uncle says, how can the right to life be inalienable if capital punishment is justified? And of course, inalienable doesn't mean you have the right no matter what. When rights apply, it's immoral to interfere. But if a person turns himself into an animal, then the principle of dealing with him as though he were a rational creature is inapplicable. So it's not that he has alienable rights, he doesn't have rights at that point. He becomes like an animal, and he doesn't have a human status. All rights depend on the fact that you deal with the person by reason. When he renounces reason, he renounces the whole principle of rights. So it's not that it becomes valid to violate his rights, it becomes valid to treat him as an animal without rights at all. And this person also asked, how do you induce that capital punishment is moral? That is too detailed for this particular course. You're getting into the content of justice, and specifically legal philosophy. And that is more detailed than I can do. I'd have to have a whole course in ethics and maybe a whole course in justice for that to even start indicating that. I'm sorry, we're right. There are still some questions that I want to try to get to next time, but that's all I can do. I used up my last second. So until next time, thank you, and what can I say? Farewell.